Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Every Monday, you and I have the opportunity to meet another man who has agreed to share his journey with us. And today is absolutely no different. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Coach Michael Taylor. Coach Michael Taylor, welcome to Mind Talk.
Hello, Pamela. It's a pleasure to be here with you today and looking forward to a great dialogue.
Well, I think we're probably going to have exactly that because you are a man of many hats. You are described as a self-educated entrepreneur, an author, a spiritual coach, and a radio talk show host. Now, as if that's not enough, your description also includes the following, which I got to ask you about. You are seeking to facilitate a shift in male consciousness, which you believe will lead to the eradication of high divorce rates, absentee fathers, and poverty, while increasing a better work-life balance as men seek a calling to joy and happiness. Oh my goodness, what a goal.
Well, it is my belief that the greatest challenge we have on the planet right now is to redefine masculinity. It is my belief that the current paradigm of masculinity is no longer sustainable because everything is changing so rapidly. And what's really driving it is if you look at the progress that women have made around the world, that to me is what's facilitating this change because a lot of people don't recognize that here in America for the first time, there are more women in the workforce than men. Secondly, there are more women graduating from college than men. So all of the roles are being flipped. And for a lot of people, it's really uncomfortable because especially as men, we're trapped in these old ways of thinking and it's really difficult for us to change. But I don't think it's something we can stop. It's part of human evolution. And so what I attempt to do is introduce men to new ways of being men, breaking up the old ways and saying, you know what, there is a better way. And the reason I came to that conclusion is because, as a man, I had done everything society says I was supposed to do to be happy and successful. I had the house, the wife, the 2.5 kids, and all of that. And then I went through a divorce, a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, basically lost everything. And so there I was, bankrupt and all alone, and I asked myself a simple question. What does it mean to be a man? Because I had done everything I thought a man was supposed to do, and yet my life was in total chaos. And so it was that question that propelled me on this 25-year journey of redefining masculinity for myself first, and then teaching other men how to do the same.
A 25-year journey. Was this a complicated lesson to learn?
Understatement of the year.
Okay.
You know, I really believe that every human being has a divine purpose. And now as I look back in retrospect of the 25-year journey that I've been on, I recognize that within all of the adversity, there were lessons and there were gifts for me. And as I look back in retrospect, I realize that all the pain, all the discomfort, all the uncertainty laid the foundation for me to become the man that I am today. And so this journey, as difficult and as painful as it was necessary for me to become the man that I am. And so I believe that, again, every person has a purpose. And so for me, my purpose is to speak, to write, to share wisdom with others, to support them in living extraordinary lives. And so this journey was perfect for me. It shaped me to become the man that I am, and now my responsibility is to share with others the lessons I've learned in hopes of supporting them in going on their own journey.
You know, I think about the men in particular who are listening to today's program who may just be 25. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them? Your journey took you 25 years, and I'm clear that it was your journey that worked for you. But for the younger guys, is it going to take them 25 years?
Well, again, everyone has their own journey, but I will say this. I think as men, we live our lives backwards. And I know I did at 25. And here's what I mean. In our culture, you know, we're taught to go out, have fun, party when we're young, chase women, do all of those types of things, accumulate stuff, And as we grow older, we start to mature a little bit. We recognize that a lot of the partying and all that wasn't as fun as we made it out to be. And so by the time we're 35, 40, we start getting serious about life. And then, we're thinking about maybe families and growing older, and our mindset changes. But unfortunately, for too many people, we wait until we're in our 50s and 60s before we start asking ourselves deeper questions. We stop or we start thinking about our health because we start having health challenges. But I think it should be the other way around. I think we should, at an early age, begin asking ourselves deeper questions. Who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose in life? And as we start asking ourselves those questions at an earlier age, we can minimize the pain that we may have to deal with later on in life. And so the challenge is to simply do what I call waking up. Because I think most of us are sleepwalking through life because we get caught up in the traps of culture and media and society and so forth, and we don't know who we really are. And so it's really about waking up. And so sometimes it takes the universe's way of waking us up is what we might consider to be adversity. So for me, my divorce and everything, as painful as it was a wake-up call. It was like, Michael, you're not doing what you were put on the planet to do. So for the younger men, I simply say, make a commitment to yourself that you're going to be willing to discover who you are. You're going to be willing to break the status quo and ask yourself some deeper questions while you're young so that the remainder of your life is a lot easier.
You know, we hear a lot about finding one's purpose. For the young men who are listening, what on earth does that really mean? And how do you do that?
Well, I think every human being has basically two purposes. We have an inner purpose and an outer purpose. Our inner purpose is to discover who we are, and that means getting to know ourselves. One of the things that I wrote about in one of my books, Black Men Rock, the first chapter was, Know Thyself. And so knowing thyself is a process of gaining a deeper understanding of who you are. And once again, we live in a culture that conditions us not to do that. We're focused externally. We're always looking at things outside of ourselves. So the first step is to know thyself, which means go on that inner journey to discover who you are. What makes you tick? What's your personality? What are your values? These are inner things. And so when we go on that inner journey, we find out who we are internally. That's the inner purpose, the outer purpose. And actually, as you're finding your inner purpose, you'll come to the discovery of your gifts and talents. And so when we find our gifts and talents and who we really are, that's our inner purpose. Our outer purpose is taking those gifts and talents to help make the world a better place, however you choose to do that. There are some people who are great writers. There are some people who are artists. There are some people who are cooks. There are some people who are mechanics who really are really good at this. Well, when they have that gift and they can take it and share it with others, then they are on purpose. And when we live a life of purpose, we live a life of fulfillment, joy, and ecstasy.
You know, the way that you explain it, I think makes it really easy to understand that, not only what do you mean when you say living your purpose, but really for the individual to understand how you get there. You know, sometimes there are catchphrases that we walk around with, and they seem so complicated or so esoteric that people will often ignore them because they don't make any sense to them. So thank you for explaining it in a way that I think is very understandable and certainly a relatively easy journey to accomplish, because what you're saying is find out who you are, not who your parents want you to be or who society wants you to be, but who you are, and then live that life. And that's a
Exactly.
it's a wonderful way to describe it. Now, you talked about a book that you have written, which is entitled Black Men Rock: 10 Keys to Empower Black Men to Live Extraordinary Lives. You begin that book describing a conversation that you had with your grandfather about race at the age of 10. Is 10 too young? Is 10 too old? Does a race conversation need to happen with a child?
Well, in my case, it was so absolutely perfect. Because my grandfather, to me, was the wisest man I've ever known. I think he had an eighth grade education, maybe not, but he was not a educated man by society standards. But he was the smartest man that I know because he would talk to me even as a child, not as a child, but as someone who he wanted to share wisdom with. And we would sit down and have these amazing conversations. And when I was a kid, I had these really huge jaws. And he called me Big Jaws. That was his name for me, Big Jaws. And he'd say, "Big Jaws, come here. I want to talk to you." And we'd sit out in the yard, and we had like a little farm. We had chickens and goats and ducks running around and everything. And we would sit out in the dirt. Well, actually, you remember those big wooden spools that the electrical companies had wire on? Those big
Yes.
wooden. Yeah, we had a table out of a really big one, and we had some chairs made out of some smaller ones. And those things still have a very special place in my heart because every time I see one, I think of my grandfather, and I think of the conversations that we would have. And the conversation that you're mentioning in terms of race, it occurred as a result of an experience I had in elementary school. I had a teacher that used to have this board up on the wall, and every time you received an A, she'd give you a gold star. Every time you received a B, I believe it was a green star, and every time you received a C, I think it was a blue star. So when you walked in the room, you saw this board, you saw all the students' names, and you saw all these different color stars. Well, it just so happens that I had the most gold stars on that board. And I was one of, let's see, I think there were four. Yeah, I think there were four black kids in my class out of maybe 25. And so here I am at the top. And right below me was a girl named Susan, who happened to be a white girl. And so we were always competing, basically, to try to see who could have the most gold stars. Well, I ended up having the most gold stars, but one day I was sort of bragging on my gold stars and me being smarter than her. And this little white girl comes to me and she says, "My mom says that you aren't smarter than me," she says, "because all black people are stupid, and there's no nigger that's going to be smarter than me," or something to that effect. I just remember the word nigger, and I was like, "What?" And
Wow.
so it literally broke my heart because I didn't know how to respond to that. And so I went home and I told my grandfather, and he could see that I was obviously very upset. And so he sat me down on our little table, and he said, "All right, Big Jaws, I want to share a story." So he gets down on the ground and he draws this circle in the dirt. And he says, "Big Jaws, I want you to imagine this is a racetrack." And he says, "Imagine that there are two people are going to have a race and they're going to race around this track." And I said, "Okay." And he says, "Now, if they both run at exactly the same speed, who will win the race?" And I said, "Well, if they run at the same speed, they would finish at the same time." He says, "Exactly." He says, "Now, what would happen if one of them had a head start?" Well, obviously that person would win. He would have a head start. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "So that's the difference between black people and white people." He said, "White people aren't smarter than black people." He said, "They simply had a head start." He said, "But guess what?" He said, "Black people are really fast, and we're catching up pretty quickly. So don't pay attention to what she said. Know that you are a smart person. You can learn whatever you want to learn. No one can keep you from learning except you." And it was that simple story that he shared with me that really shaped my perception of what it meant to be a black kid in America. My grandfather confirmed for me that, and obviously I had the results on the wall with all the stars that I was smarter, if you will. But it was something in how he shared that story with me that I internalized that as a black kid, I can be as smart as I want to be. No one can keep me from being smart. And that was the thing that really carried me, knowing that my grandfather, number one, had faith and confidence in me, but knowing that black people, as he put it, or white people, had simply had a head start. They weren't smarter or better. They just had a head start. And that really helped me process being black in America.
You know, that what's interesting, I think, about that story is there are lots of things that are interesting, but the one sentence that really sort of stood out for me was that you can learn whatever you choose, and nobody can get in the way of that except you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is really empowering.
Very empowering. And interestingly enough, my teacher, who happened to be a white female, Miss Bussey, I'll never forget Miss Bussey. I absolutely loved Miss Bussey. Miss Bussey was really the catalyst for my learning, because she recognized that, first of all, she knew that I was in a very abusive environment because I would come to school with scars, and she took extra time to nurture me. And as a matter of fact, she was sort of a little heavyset woman, and every morning she would hug me. She would give me a hug. "Good morning, Michael. How are you?" And she gave me special attention. And I was like, I guess you would call it a teacher's pet. But I absolutely love Miss Buffy. Yeah. She gave me that extra attention. But she instilled in me, "Michael, your ticket out of here is your brain, your intelligence. Don't be afraid to be smart." And even to this day, my mom still has, I had A honor roll for like 4 years in a row. I had 3 years of perfect attendance in school. And my mom still has in this little notebook all the little accomplishments that I had when I was in elementary school.
The abuse that you were dealing with at home, it certainly wasn't with Granddad. It doesn't sound like he was a wonderful role model for you. How were you being harmed? Who was harming you?
Well, my grandmother, his wife, was the complete opposite. She was a woman who literally, and I mean it's literally, hated me. And she hated me because whenever she would talk bad about my mom, I would defend my mom. I didn't allow her to badmouth my mom, and I would say things, and she would slap me or hit me with a shoe or hit me across the face with an extension cord. Or, I mean, she was a raging alcoholic that was completely out of control, filled with rage, filled with anger, and she took it all out on me.
And it sounds like those weren't the times when teachers were mandated to report suspected abuse.
Right.
That would have had a huge impact on your life.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got to remember, this was 67, 68 or so.
Okay.
And things were a little different. But, again, the amazing thing was that there was a case where the Child Protective Services, and I don't know if it was called that back then. I don't remember it being called that. But I do remember them once calling them on my grandmother because of some injuries I had suffered.
Huh. Okay.
And my teacher recognized it and reported it. So there was one case. I remember them coming to the school and taking me home.
Interesting. Well, that's good to know that at least, you know, the teacher was savvy enough and aware enough about what abuse looks like, not only physically, because a lot of abuse isn't physical, or at least it's right. Sort of below the neckline, so you can't really see it.
Right.
A lot of abuse is emotional as well. One of the things that you say in Black Men Rock is that the greatest challenge you see as Black men is to recognize that being Black is not a disadvantage. You go on to say, this does not mean that racism, discrimination, and a myriad of other challenges don't exist. Say more about that.
Well, I made a comment once that I am a man who happens to be Black, not just a Black man. And it created sort of an uproar when I said it. And I clarified it by saying, if I say that I am a man who happens to be Black, it doesn't deny my ethnicity. It simply affirms my humanity. And so what I mean by that is I have experienced every type of racism imaginable. I personally have dealt with KKK members, personally, in the 80s. I have had a gun put to my head simply because I'm Black. I have had my life threatened by a white father because I was dating his daughter. So I know firsthand what racism looks like. I've experienced it even to this day, have experiences with it, but I've never allowed it to stop me from accomplishing what I wanted to accomplish in life. And so it is my belief that the external narrative about black men is that we are angry, lazy, less intelligent. These are the external narratives that are perpetuated throughout our media and society as a whole. What I recognize is I can't control anything outside of me. What I can control is what's going on inside of me. So what I have to be willing to do is change the narrative in my own mind. I have to be willing to see myself as I am, not how the media projects me to be. And so for men of color, I believe that's the key. We must change the inner narrative of how we feel and what we think about ourselves, because we have no control over what the media is going to put out there. And so that's why I write.
Michael, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to delve more into the ways in which one begins to control the inner narrative, because you're right. You can't do anything about what other people say and do around you. Your greatest power and your greatest resource is what you can do within yourself. So let's pick up there when we come back.
Okay.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We'll be back in just a moment. Coach Michael Taylor, you were talking just before the break about the impact that a negative media can have. And it is certainly true that for as long as I can remember, the media has been quite good at pigeonholing people in general. But with respect to men, you know, men were really put in, men of all colors, were really put in a very narrowly defined box. And that became perhaps even more narrow when you added the experience of being a black man. So how do you combat those images that have been and likely will continue to be all around us?
Well, once again, the first chapter is know thyself. And I believe that's the key. It's the only way, because there's a wonderful saying that says, if you don't go within, you will always go without. And my interpretation of that is, if I don't go within to discover the things that are keeping me from being who I really am, then I'll go without expressing who I really am. And so changing the narrative is really about asking yourself, how do I really see myself? Because I know there's a lot of cases where I'll hear a brother say something like, I'm just a poor black man trying to get by. And it's so deeply ingrained in his mindset that there's no way he can ever really succeed with that mindset, because he's already made up his mind that he's just a poor black man trying to get by.
And he could be actually a CEO, but the mindset is there.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the challenge. When we allow the negative media to shape how we think, then we are victims to the media, and we lose control of our destiny. The only way to break free, I believe, is, once again, is to do the inner work to wake up to who you really are. And this is a process. And again, it doesn't have to take 25 years. I mean, for some people, it may take a month. It may take one book. It may take one conversation. A person can shift their life in a moment, but it's all about making a choice. And that choice is, I am going to discover who I really am. I am going to not allow the externals to affect me. And it's easier said than done, but it's definitely doable. You see, there's a lot of amazing thing that's going on in science these days that a lot of people don't recognize. I think so many people get caught up into the negativity of the media that their perception is that the world is going to hell in a handbasket. That is not my perception. My perception is that as a species, as a human species, we're actually waking up. Human beings are still evolving, and we're evolving in consciousness. And so I believe what's happening is that as we gain more knowledge and wisdom, which to me is actually evolution, as we gain this knowledge and wisdom, we begin preparing ourselves to move past, or shall I say, eradicate a lot of the issues that you mentioned in the intro, like domestic violence, fatherlessness, and all this. See, I believe all of these things can be resolved, but it can't happen outside of us. It can only happen inside of us. We have to be willing, especially as men, to begin recognizing that the old ways of being men no longer work. And we have to be open to some new ways. But once again, we're talking about hundreds of years of male conditioning, so it's not going to happen in a day. But I believe that it's inevitable. It cannot not happen. Because once again, I personally believe in that, in human evolution. But every man simply has to make a choice. And that choice is, I am going to wake up to who I really am. And in doing so, because the saying is that only a hurt person hurts another person. And so until we become willing to deal with our hurt, we can't stop people from hurting other people. And when we focus our attention on that, then I believe we begin eradicating a lot of the social ills that we talked about.
The saying that only a hurt person hurts is certainly one that I would suggest is on target. And you talked about a period of time in which you chose to enter therapy. And I will tell you that early in my career as a psychotherapist, my clientele was zero men and very few people of color. I'm really pleased to say that at this point, at least in my career, I can honestly say it's about 50-50, and many more men of color, many more men, period, but certainly many more men of color are coming in to get the assistance that, quite frankly, they deserve. But for you, being an African-American male in therapy, when you were going to therapy, were any of your friends going to therapy? Were you sort of the odd man out, literally?
Well, literally, yes. And I was too ashamed to even tell anyone I was in therapy. So, you know, there's that stigma that going to therapy is a sign of weakness. I think men of color have some unique challenges in that not only do we have to deal with the male stigma, but as a black guy, you start asking questions like, do I have to have a black therapist? Will a white therapist be able to understand my issues? I mean, so there's all these complicated challenges that we're faced with. But I concur with your optimism as far as where we're going, because I remember when I started this process, and I did begin with a white female therapist who was just wonderful, really helped me get started on my journey. And I remember, though, as I went through therapy and started doing all my healing and growing and everything, there were, as you mentioned, very few men and very few resources for men to talk about what it meant to be a man. There were a few guys out there, like Robert Bly had written a book called Iron John, and there was a guy named Sam Keen who wrote a book called Fire in the Belly, which were really wonderful books. But one of the reasons that I started writing in 95 was because none of those writers had written books toward the Black experience. And so when I wrote Brothers, Are You Listening? And I started talking about going to therapy and changing our lives, it was my attempt as a man of color to share with other men of color the process where sometimes people are comfortable in an environment in which the person doesn't look like them. And so what I've attempted to do is to first and foremost recognize that masculinity has nothing to do with ethnicity. But at the same time, I think it's important for safety, emotional and psychological safety, for men of color to have a place where they can go if they're not comfortable with people who don't look like them. And so there are very few, even today, men of color in the personal growth space, the self-help space, if you will. And so the way I see it is it's my responsibility to fill that void, to provide men of color an opportunity to grow and to change. And so I, as yourself, have noticed over the last 25 years an incredible shift, not just in men, but definitely in the men's movement, if you will, but also men of color, I believe, are now waking up. And as I mentioned earlier, because I do believe in evolution, I believe that this waking up is simply part of the evolution of consciousness on the planet, is that humanity is waking up. We're starting to recognize how our thoughts, our subconscious mind, all these things work. And when we start getting into this conversation, we begin getting to the cause of a lot of the dysfunction in our lives and in society.
You, the subtitle of your book, Black Men Rock, is 10 Keys to Empower Black Men to Live Extraordinary Lives. And the key number two is develop a spiritual connection. Are you talking about religion? What are you talking about, and why is that important?
Well, the chapter is develop a spiritual connection that nurtures your soul. And my belief is that spirituality, and this is my definition of spirituality, the moment-to-moment recognition and acknowledgement of my connection to something greater than myself. Let me say that again. The moment-to-moment recognition and acknowledgement of my connection to something greater than myself. So with that definition, it has absolutely nothing to do with organized religion. It has everything to do with recognizing that as a human being, we are connected to something divine. And so I think most people, when it comes to religion, they accept a philosophy based on their families and their cultures without questioning why they believe that. Very few people, I think, will actually ask themselves deeper questions about the divine, about spirituality, about God. And so what I say, as a former atheist who was a confirmed atheist for several years, what I say and what I recognize is that I, through this process, through this journey that I've been on, was able to develop a spiritual connection that transcends any religion or dogma or doctrine. And it nurtures my soul. It's my truth that I am connected to. It is not my job to try to convince anybody of that. It's just what's true for me. And what I have found is as I went through this process of healing and growing, I came to the conclusion early on that I didn't need God or I didn't need this connection because me being the rational-minded person that I am, as I was doing my healing work through therapy, I concluded that, wait a minute, if I heal my emotional wounds from childhood and I'm starting to feel better about myself and all of my pain was the result of this traumatic experience as a child, and why do I need God? What's the purpose? It just didn't click for me because for so long, I try to understand God in my head. I tried to understand it rationally, and it didn't make sense to me, and that's why I rejected religion for so long. But as I went through this process, and I started healing and growing, and I got to a place where I was really happy with my life, with myself, things were going good, and I was like, something's still missing. I didn't know what it was. Something was still missing. And so I had been brought up Baptist, and then I just came to the conclusion, well, maybe the problem isn't with the Baptist teaching. Maybe it's Christianity. And so I moved away from Christianity, and I started researching Buddhism. A lot of stuff that I loved about Buddhism that really sparked my interest in something deeper than myself. So I got heavily involved in that. I said, wait a minute. What if there's something else to be learned over here? So I went to a Jewish synagogue, and I started talking to these guys about what they believed and why they believed. And I went, that's interesting. Well, let's go over here. So then I go over and I started talking to some Muslims. I said, so what do you believe and why do you believe that? And so I went on this amazing journey to find what really worked for me. And I came to what's been called New Thought. New Thought Christianity takes a different approach to traditional religion by simply stating that Jesus came to show us how to access the divinity within us. That was his mission. His mission wasn't to be the savior or anything like that. His mission was to say, and by his own admission, he said, these things and even greater things you shall do also. And so my conclusion is that Jesus was the greatest expression of divinity that any human being has ever accomplished. I don't think it makes him any better than Muhammad or any better than Buddha or any better than any other spiritual teachers, but I believe he reached that level of oneness with Source, with God, as I understand it, his Father, he called it, that works for me.
Which is truly an extraordinary gift that one can allow oneself to experience. A lot of times I would suggest that people are so used to quote-unquote believing and living what was their parents' truth or their caregiver's truth that they absolutely lose sight of what's true for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was my point, because I think it's our challenge to ask ourselves, what do I really believe and why? And so if you ask people, why do they go to church? I think for most people, it's more of a duty and obligation thing versus I'm going to be spiritually nurtured. It's like, okay, I'm supposed to go to church every Sunday. But I tried that for a long time. That didn't work. And once again, for me, what works is every moment I have an opportunity to recognize that the Source, as I choose to call it, is present. And it is in every moment that I have access to this presence that's in me all the time. And that's very comforting. That soothes my soul. And that's what drives me now.
Coach Michael Taylor, who is the author of several books, including Black Men Rock, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to what may sound like to some shifting gears, and that I'm going to ask you what your thoughts are about finances and why you think that's an important part of one's experience. Folks, don't go away. We'll be right back. Michael Taylor, of the list of 10 keys that you talk about in Black Men Rock, number 8 is Manage Your Finances 101. What does finances have to do with all these other things we've been talking about?
Well, I use the term financial abundance. And financial abundance simply means that you have enough money that you're not stressing out over it. And so for a very long time, my belief was that, or shall I say, I was trapped in the more syndrome. I always needed more, more this, more that, more stuff. And so I was constantly on this treadmill, if you will, of more. And I think a lot of people get trapped on that treadmill because we think we have to have more because of our culture. Our culture tells us that we have to have the cars, the houses, the money, the diamonds, the jewelry, the clothes, and all of that. And so we lose touch with what's really important, and we allow our finances to get out of whack, to put it mildly. And so for me, as I mentioned, when I was 23 years old, actually 22, I bought my first house. And very proud of that fact.
That's but impressive.
What I recognize, though, is that all that time, I bought the house, I had the vacations, I had the cars, I had all, so I had done all this stuff. But everything I was doing was done out of a sense of emotional scarcity. And what I mean by that is, internally, I was so filled with shame, I thought by accomplishing all of these things, it would make people like me. And so my attention was impressing other people with my stuff. And so I was always buying all this stuff so that people could say, man, Michael Taylor's got it going on. Well, that's one of the reasons why I ended up going through bankruptcy, foreclosure, and all of that, because I was trying to impress other people with my stuff. And so when I start talking about managing your finances, more importantly, what I'm talking about is getting into the right mindset that you don't have to have stuff to be happy. And there's nothing wrong with making lots of money. Nothing wrong with that. But the question becomes, what is the feeling, what is the mindset that's driving your spending habits? And so if you aren't willing to look at that, it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, for you to ever get a handle on your finances. Because everything starts in mind, our thoughts and our beliefs about whatever it is we're talking about. So it starts there. So if we have a scarcity mindset, and you hear people always talking about how they see something and their initial thought is, I can't afford that. It's a mindset. So mind controls everything. So if you don't think you can afford certain things, then the mindset will drive that. So what we have to be willing to do is have a mindset of abundance. And the mindset of abundance means, first of all, I am worthy. And believe it or not, that's where it starts. I am worthy. Not worthy in a sense that I have to have things outside of me. It's just worthy saying that I am enough without stuff. I am whole just as I am. I don't have to buy anything to be happy with myself. So when I get that mindset and I'm happy with that, then whatever money flows to me, I won't abuse it. I'll be willing to save. I'll be willing to think about 20 years down the road. I completely change my mindset and attitude and relationship with money. And so and there's some specific things about managing finances, like, you know, taking care of your credit and all of that. But it's really more about changing our relationship to money. And that's what I try to talk about.
The idea that one can actually experience a sense of being whole within themselves and don't need all the external supplies, if you will, is huge. And freeing. But even more than freeing, I mean, it's just absolutely huge to be able to be still and really joyful with yourself, which doesn't mean you have to be perfect.
Mm-hmm. Well, people will argue with you. I've had several confrontations with people in seminars in which they said, but wait a minute, I got to have this. I said, what if I told you don't have to have anything to be happy. 99% of the people in the room will not agree with that, because our mindset has been, we've been conditioned to believe that our worth is associated with how much stuff we have. Let me share this quick story. After I'd gone through my divorce, bankruptcy, and I was homeless for 2 years, I finally got enough money to get my own apartment again after being homeless for 2 years. I had this apartment with no furniture. The only thing I had was an air mattress and some clothes in this apartment. And it just so happened that the air mattress was a borrowed air mattress from a friend. So it's August. I'm in Houston, Texas, in an apartment. I couldn't afford to have the lights turned on yet. I had just me and my little apartment. And I was sitting up late one night, and I had my headphones on. And there's a song by BB and CC Winings called Searching for Love. And in the song, he asked a question. He says, "Searching for love, has anyone found it?" And as I was listening to this song, I started looking around my apartment, and I had nothing, literally nothing. And I started thinking about the journey I had been on, going to therapy, doing my healing work, being homeless. And all of a sudden, as I was listening to the song and I'm looking around, I got life's ultimate paradox in an instant. And the paradox is this: having absolutely everything and absolutely nothing at the same time.
Interesting.
And in that moment, as I came to that realization, I started to cry. Because I got it. I got it. It's like, okay, I got it. It doesn't take anything outside of me to be happy. Because as I was sitting in that room, in that hot room with nothing, I was happier than I had ever been in my life at that moment. And there were just tears of joy just streaming down my face. And I was like, God, I get it. I finally get it. I'm whole just as I am without stuff.
An amazingly transformative experience.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Talk for a moment about men and tears.
We have been taught that first and foremost, we are not supposed to feel. That is the male conditioning of our society and culture. And yet, what we do in not allowing ourselves to feel is we begin repressing and suppressing emotion, which causes all sorts of dysfunction in our lives. And so the question becomes, if there is a creator, which I choose to believe there is, there's a reason that we have emotions, and I believe emotions are simply energy in motion. And so what we have to be willing to do is allow ourselves to feel and be okay with how we feel and the feelings, the energy that's moving through us. And so when I went to therapy for the first time, I had so much repressed pain that I'm sitting there talking to the therapist, and she's asking me to share some of the things that I went through as a child. And as I shared the things, I was smiling. And she asked me, "Michael, why are you smiling? Those things were horrible." And my response, which was my response to everything, was, "I'm okay." Now, think about that. I'm in a therapist's office, and I'm saying, "I'm okay." But anyway, as I sat there, she looked at me, and she said, "Michael, how would you feel if those same things happened to your son?" And when she said that, it's like I got out of my head and went into my heart and allowed myself to feel years of suppressed pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to cry in a way that I wasn't prepared for. So I allowed it to happen for maybe 10 seconds. And then I went back into my head and I started questioning. I said, "How did you do that? What did you just do? What?" And she says, "Michael, you've got all this repressed pain that you've got to be willing to let go." And that was the beginning of my transformation, allowing myself to let go of all that pain and hurt that I'd been carrying for 30 years. And so for men, we have all these defense mechanisms that don't allow us to feel and express how we feel, and tears being a release that allows us to let go of the negative energy that we're holding on to, we've got to be willing to let men know that it's okay, and it's actually mandatory to get to the joy. And we've got to be willing to say, you know what? I'm going to allow myself to feel and put ourselves in an environment with someone, a safe environment in which we can do that. And that's one of the real challenges for men because, as mentioned, we're taught not to feel.
And certainly not to express any feelings that you might allow to eke through.
Right. Well, again, I think the greatest journey for any man is that 11-inch journey from his head to his heart. And that's a real challenge to get men to do. Because, again, once our conditioning of our culture says that men aren't supposed to go there. But more and more men are waking up. And I am extremely optimistic. And that's why I write. That's why I speak. Because my job is to share and support men in doing so.
You say that fear is the root cause of many men's refusal to change. Fear of what?
Well, some people say that there's really only two emotions, fear and love. And so when we talk about fear, ultimately, I think the fear is we're not good enough. There's a part of us that may have been wounded as a child, or we may have had some experience that we simply made a decision that we're not good enough. And so the fear is, if I allow myself to be vulnerable, if I allow someone to really see me, I'm at risk for being hurt in some way. So therefore, in order to protect ourselves, we create these walls, these barriers around our hearts that don't allow us to feel. And so the fear is allowing ourselves to feel, because one of the things that terrified me once I had that experience with my therapist was that feeling, that sadness, that pain that I was holding on to, terrified. I was so afraid to allow that to come through. It hurt. And so it took a while till I became comfortable enough to allow myself to get into an environment that I could really feel and let go of all that hurt. And when I really opened that door, as scary as it was, as painful as it was, then I became free. And it was a process. And after I went to therapy, I only went to 5 sessions of therapy. The reason I left therapy, because I was too terrified to really deal with my stuff. Fortunately for me, when I left therapy, and actually I gave the therapist an excuse, but the truth was I was terrified of, because she suggested that I go to group therapy because she said she had done all she could do for me. She needed me to go and connect with other people, and I was terrified of that. But I ran to the right place. I ran to workshops like John Bradshaw and some other stuff that really helped me continue my growth. But ultimately, I had to face the fear that I wasn't good enough, that there was something wrong with me. And then when I faced that head on and allowed people to be there for me, I really grew and transformed.
You say that referring to the men for whom you've written Black Men Rock, you say we should not be placed in a black box. But the name of your book is Black Men Rock. So explain that.
Okay, so when you look at the black box that I'm speaking of, we talked about the external narrative. We talked about the stereotypes that society has put us in. When I say black men rock, it is an affirmation of the awesomeness that we have within us. It's changing that narrative from black men are lazy and stereotypical, all that stuff. So when I say black men rock, it's simply an affirmation to black men to recognize that they do, that black men do rock. Black men are awesome. We just have to convince ourselves of it sometimes because of all the external narratives I spoke about. And so changing the mindset is always the key to transformation. And so Black Men Rock is the changing of a mindset. So what if we were to get Black men to recognize that they really do rock, that they don't have to buy into the stereotypes driven by the media? Everything would change in an instant if we could get Black men to see themselves that way. Now, obviously, it's easier said than done, but it begins with each individual brother coming to the understanding that he does rock. And put another way, he is an awesome expression of divinity. That's what he is. He just has to wake up to that.
So he can come out of the box.
Absolutely.
Gotcha. Michael, you have written many things, and I know you're doing a lot of work. You reference organizations, the Mankind Project. Very briefly, can you tell us what that is?
Yes, the Mankind Project is an organization that I highly endorse because they develop programs specifically for transforming men. And it is a three-day weekend that literally will shift your life in a way that I can't even begin to try to explain. So it's an organization that I've been active with for probably 15 years. And I don't believe in trying to reinvent the wheel. This organization really has the tools and processes to really support men in their transformation. And it's something that I really, really recommend highly to any man who is sitting there listening to this and going, well, what can I do specifically? Well, if you ask me one thing you can do that will literally change your life, that would be it. Attend the Mankind Project weekend called the New Warrior Training.
And the Mankind Project is for a particular group of men or all men?
All men. And they, over the last several years, they have had a huge push to get men of color involved. As a matter of fact, there's several online groups of men of color who have done the weekend, who came together and have created organizations that support men of color who have gone through the process, who are thinking about the process, and may not be comfortable knowing that, you know, will there be other brothers involved? And so there's lots of men of color now who are actively involved, which is really exciting because when I started this process and when I did the New Warrior Weekend, I was the only man of color during the entire weekend. And so when we look at men of color that are now beginning to wake up to this, I get really excited because I'm not the only guy anymore. There's lots of us. And there's even men of color who are actually facilitators of the process. So lots of men of color are getting involved. And once again, that's another reason for my optimism.
Now, Michael, we're going to have to get out of here. But before we do, tell us how folks can get in touch with you or learn more about all the wonderful things you're doing.
Well, for all the men of color out there who may be listening, if they go to BMRacademy.com, if they're really ready to transform their lives and get started, it's a great resource for them there, BMRacademy.com. And if you just want to contact Coach Michael Taylor, just go to CoachMichaelTaylor.com, and you can find out all about me, where I am, what I'm doing, and all of that.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela.
Folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk comes to you daily as an educational public service. It is not designed to take away any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org, mindtalk.org. You can also carry Mind Talk in your pocket. You can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store and from Google Play. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, leave a comment. Please send me an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. And I'd love to know where you are listening to Mind Talk, the part of the country or the world that you are listening to us from. Again, pamela@mindtalk.org. Remember, always, if it's unacceptable, then that's exactly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.